Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, a biopharmaceutical business with a deep-rooted heritage in oncology and a commitment to developing cancer medicines for patients. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers features the latest information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about the diagnosis and treatment of skull-based tumors with Dr. Bulent Omay. Dr. Omay is an assistant professor of neurosurgery at Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Gore is a professor of internal medicine and hematology at Yale and director of hematologic malignancies at Smilo Cancer Hospital.
You know, I didn't even know until about an hour ago that there was such a thing, an area as skull-based tumors. And I bet our listening audience doesn't have a clue. Are you a surgeon?
Yes. So I'm a neurosurgeon. So mm-hmm. So neurosurgery is a specialty that deals with diseases of the nervous system and the surgical treatment of them.
And they're also the brunt of jokes like he's not, you know, this isn't neuroscience, right? This isn't neurosurgery.
That's true. So, a skull-based surgeon is actually a subspecialty of neurosurgery, and it's defines the neurosurgeon who deals with pathologies, and this is most of the time tumors, that arise at the base of the skull.
Okay.
And the reason it became a subspecialty is because it's a very complex area of the body where the brain interacts with the rest of the body. And the skull base actually holds the brain, and it has a lot of foramina in Latin, or like holes that cranial nerves, major vessels pass through. And it creates this very complex anatomy that requires another subspecialty to get trained and to have experience in it.
I can imagine, because I know that if I had been to a medical school where I had to actually take a test on those various holes in the base of the skull, for sure I would not be where I am today. Fortunately, I was a Yale medical student where it was kind of an open book test. So I remember how complicated that was.
Yeah. And there are common questions in tests.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of holes, as I recall.
Yeah.
So are these tumors arising out of the bone, or are they arising out of the brain tissue or the lining outside the brain, or all of the above?
I guess the answer would be all of the above,
mm-hmm.
because this area, the skull base, is essentially, as I said, a complex area filled with different types of tissues. And that creates different types of cancers, essentially. So tumors can arise from the brain itself, from the covering of the brain, dura. They can be outside the brain or dura, and can arise from the bone, cartilage at the skull base level. It can arise from the cranial nerves that have just exited the brain. Sometimes there can be like cysts associated in this area. And sometimes there are some like embryologic remnants that grow over time and create problems and act like tumors, again, in this area.
Mm-hmm. You mean like leftovers of tissue that should have developed when the person was an embryo or fetus, and somehow that primitive tissue remained?
Correct. Skull base, and especially like midline skull base, is a common area that these kinds of tissues can grow and create problems.
Huh. Well, now I'm kind of nervous. If I had a problem at the base of my skull, would I know it?
I guess yes or no.
Uh-oh. I was thinking it was an easy question.
Yeah. So the way I end up seeing patients in my clinic is like there are like two different groups. One of them is the incidental diagnoses, which like a patient ends up having a brain scan, either a CT or an MRI of the brain for... let's say for a minor trauma,
mm-hmm.
gets involved in an accident, they scan the brain and find a lesion.
Or bad headache or something like that,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Sometimes they have symptoms, and that kind of prompts the imaging, and a lesion is found that way. And that can be, as you said, headaches, again, this area, because it's kind of a tightly spaced area with different tissues and critical structures, nerves that carry vision, optic nerves, or like nerves that involve movements of the face, facial muscles, or the sensation to the face. All these nerves are like closely packed in the skull base area. And any lesion, even small lesions that start growing in that area can interact with these structures and create symptoms like headaches, facial pain, vision loss, and sometimes tumors that involve the frontal sinuses or the sinuses in the face, sphenoid sinus, can create problems with functions of the sinuses and the nose, like a blockade of the nose. Hmm. Actually, there are a variety of ways that these tumors can present themselves.
So, in general, patients would be referred to you because somebody else has done a scan that showed a problem.
True. Most of the time, when I end up seeing a patient, they already have a scan done and have a preliminary diagnosis of a skull-based tumor.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know at that point whether it's a malignant tumor or potentially a benign tumor or what it is in general?
We don't. At least we don't know with accuracy. Mm-hmm. So usually it is possible to make an educated guess about what a tumor would be, but without pathological diagnosis, it's impossible to tell for sure whether a tumor is malignant or benign.
Well, that sounds like that must be a very terrifying diagnosis for a patient to find out you've got something bad at the base of your skull. Go see this guy at Yale. He's the face of skull surgeon. Just seems like that would be like really terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I totally think about that when I interact with the patients because having a tumor diagnosis is like one thing. It's bad on its own, but also having a tumor in this area, which is very hard to reach. Adds another level of complexity and anxiety on the patient level. I do my best to kind of be clear to the patients that, this is going to be a journey and they need help from their family and also they need to understand, what we're dealing with and how we're going to deal with that, in detail. Mm. Because I think that is key to dealing with the anxiety of this situation, just understanding
sure.
what is going on.
Right. So I imagine the first step must be to get a biopsy and find out what you're dealing with, or is that not the case?
So each case is evaluated like individually in a way and somewhat like tailored to the patient. Mm-hmm. Some of them may require a biopsy, but sometimes we have enough evidence that we pretty much can guess what the tumor would be. In that case, we may proceed with the goal of resecting the tumor, not doing the biopsy first.
Taking it out completely.
Correct. Taking it out completely. And when we have a pathological evaluation afterwards, we will know what it is.
I see.
But regardless, when we start the operation and first encounter the tumor, we send samples to the pathologist even before proceeding with the removal of the tumor.
Well, so while you're actually there and the patient's head is open.
Yes. So the pathologist quickly reviews the slides and gives us a mostly reliable answer about what he or she thinks this tumor is. Mm-hmm. And that gives like another level of confidence to moving forward with the full removal of the tumor.
Well, is there any circumstance under which you would not take the tumor out?
Yes. So there are some scenarios where we may decide to stop the operation at that point because the tumor that we think is diagnosed at this point may be treatable with medications.
I see.
So in that case, then the patient would not be subject to the potential complications of a resection, removal of the mm-hmm. tumor, and we might just stop at that point and start medical therapy.
So that might be if it's something like a lymphoma or something that's very responsive to treatment.
Correct. Lymphoma is a typical scenario that happens in these. This is not a rare situation. This is not a common situation. It's very rare that it happens, because there are ways that we can guess that a lesion may be lymphoma before we plan mm-hmm. this, and we might just do a biopsy at that point.
I see. So I'm still trying to get my head, so to speak, around this complicated area, and I just can't imagine how do you go in there? Like, well, how do you do that safely? Because it's connected to the brainstem, which is connected to the spinal cord, and all those nerves that feed swallowing and the tongue and taste and hearing and all that stuff. That's like such a poorly designed area evolutionarily, right? In terms of like, you know, if anything's going to go bad, everything goes bad right there, right?
That is correct.
It's consciousness. It's a crazy place.
That is totally true. So unfortunately, the anatomy is like very complex and unpredictable in a way. So each patient is different. So first of all, we start with evaluating the patient's images, the MRI scans, and have an idea about like where the tumor is, what are the neighboring structures, what is it interacting with, and why are the symptoms occurring the way they occur, and how can we approach this. So in skull-based surgery, the approach is kind of a very common theme, like how are we going to approach this tumor? Because
sure.
There might be very critical structures between the surgeon and the tumor as we're approaching the tumor, and we have to approach it.
And you can't get there from the top of the head, right?
No, we don't want to go through the brain, for sure.
That sounds terrible, right?
Yes. So over the years, there has been like very innovative ways have been developed to approach these lesions, and these are described as skull-based approaches. There are the conventional skull-based approaches, which require like big incisions over the scalp or the face sometimes, and big bony openings that can give access to the surgeon by navigating around these critical neural and vascular structures and the brain without manipulating them too much.
So you like make a big window in the bone, sort of?
Correct. So that is the conventional way of skull-based approaches. But especially in the last 10 years, another method has arisen. So this is the endoscopic method to skull-based approaches. So the idea or the strategy of the endoscopic method is to use natural corridors that already exist in the body, in the face and the cranium, and bring the actual like light source and the lens that is required to do these surgeries close to the pathology where the tumor is, using these corridors, and make smaller bony openings, and use the endoscope, which is a very innovative way of like approaching these and visualizing these lesions, and do the resections that way.
So are you talking about going through some of those holes you talked about in the base of the skull, or
no.
through the sinuses, or what are
no,
you doing?
No, through the sinuses. So the typical approach is the endoscopic endonasal approach, which means that the endoscope is goes through the nose. Goes through the sphenoid sinus most commonly.
That's a sinus that's behind the nose, kind of, right?
Correct. So sphenoid sinus is essentially in the center of the head, under the brain, and behind the nose. So it's almost like a natural opening to get access to the skull base without going through the brain, without the need to retract brain. This is done jointly with an ENT surgeon.
So that would be a head and neck surgeon?
Correct. So the head and neck surgeon actually does the nose part of the operation and brings the surgical team like into the sphenoid sinus where the skull base is visible. So the top of the sphenoid sinus is essentially the skull base.
All right. Well, this is very exciting because not only do you get your tumor resected, but it sounds like you might get a nose job. But right now, we need to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about skull-based tumors with Dr. Omei.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, a science-led biopharmaceutical company dedicated to partnering with leading scientific companies, organizations, and the community to improve outcomes for advanced cancer patients. More at AstraZeneca-US.com. This is a medical minute about genetic testing, which can be useful for people with certain types of cancer that seem to run in their families. Patients that are considered at risk receive genetic counseling and testing so informed medical decisions can be based on their own personal risk assessment. Resources for genetic counseling and testing are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers. Interdisciplinary teams include geneticists, genetic counselors, physicians, and nurses who work together to provide risk assessment and steps to prevent the development of cancer. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore. I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Bulent Omai, and we are discussing the diagnosis and treatment of skull-based tumors. Bulent, just before the break, I made this unfortunate joke about the head and neck surgeon. I guess it's really a plastic surgeon that would do the nose job classically. So, and it's not really funny to make light of what's a really serious problem. So I apologize if I offended anybody. I was just trying to make light. But so you were giving us this fascinating story about how the head and neck surgeon puts the endoscope through the nose into this big sinus in there called the sphenoid sinus. And what you said right before the break was that the top of the sphenoid sinus is the skull. Is that right?
That is true.
Scary.
That is
okay,
true.
So do you take the roof of the sphenoid sinus off?
Yeah, so at that point, once we bring our endoscope into the sphenoid sinus, which is this air-filled cavity which already exists in every patient.
I mean, are we talking about something that's an inch or half an inch or 3 inches? How big is the sinus?
Probably an inch. Probably
tiny.
An inch.
That's
tiny.
Yeah. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It's actually very variable, like from patient to patient, but it can be small, it can be large.
Okay.
But it's large enough so that we can bring our endoscope in and get our instruments in there so that we can access the skull base.
Are the instruments part of the endoscope or they're separate?
They're separate.
So they're in some other flexible tubey thing.
Yeah, they're not. They're actually straight. They're not flexible.
Really?
But they're very elegant, long structures, like designed instruments that help us do these surgeries.
They must be tiny, right? Because they're going through
they
this.
Are.
You're manipulating within this inch space or so, right? And they've got to be tiny, tiny.
They are. They are. They're very small.
Millimeters or?
For example, the scissors that we use, the endoscopic scissors, yes, are probably a couple of millimeters in length in a way.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how wide is the clip part of the scissors?
So they are attached to this like long base,
right,
that comes out of the nose, and the surgeon is actually operating out of the nose in a way and using
with a microscope or something or
so the endoscope.
Yeah.
So the endoscope is actually like in the sphenoid sinus, and it brings the light source and the lens like very close to the pathology. So there's
got some goggles or some optical ways to look in, right?
So it creates this like high definition image, and it's kind of projected into our monitors. So we're actually
TV. You're doing TV surgery.
Correct.
You
correct.
Heard it here, folks. Your base of the skull is on TV.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. It's actually.
I guess you can really blow it up big, huh? Right.
Yes. Yes.
High
yes.
Def TV. No doubt. No.
Correct. Correct. I mean, it creates like very impressive images.
I even can imagine.
So,
go ahead, please.
So once we're there, we also use what we call a navigation system, which is used like in very different types of brain surgery, but it is very important in skull-based surgery as well. So this is almost like a typical navigation device that
you mean like a GPS kind of thing?
Like a GPS, exactly, that tells us where we are.
In the brain,
in the skull, and we can check another monitor to make sure that we are actually like in the place that we want to be on an MRI. So we kind of correlate what we are in actual reality to where we are, where we would be on an MRI scan.
But there's not an MRI machine in the room.
No, there isn't.
Okay.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So after all these like checks are done, we use a drill, almost like a dentist's drill, that is like very small. An elegant instrument that can create a hole in the skull base.
Okay.
So once we create that hole, now we have access to the brain essentially, and what is like under the brain between the skull and the brain. Mm. So and then we proceed with the operation, and you know once we get access, we remove the pathology and at that point we deal with the problem of closing the defect. So in skull-based surgery, there's always this strategic problem of closing a skull-based defect.
You've got a hole in there.
Correct. And that hole is communicating with the nose.
Ooh.
So that needs to be closed. And together with...
Super glue is not enough.
It is never enough. So we usually use a vascularized tissue that is derived from the nose and almost like a plastics flap that is created within the nose.
Sort of like a graft, like almost like a skin graft, but
correct.
It's using nose tissue?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we use that graft to close this defect, in addition to other methods. But the graft is kind of key in these kinds of closures. So brain ends up being separated from the nose.
Huh. And the brain, those tissues, like those membranes that surround the brain, do they grow back or are they, you don't need them?
They eventually heal. Mm-hmm. They eventually heal. And especially this vascularized flap is the key to that healing process.
Wow. So I know that in a lot of, or at least in some brain surgeries, from what I understand, you know, they keep the patient partially awake so that they can make sure they stimulate a part of the brain and stuff. Are these patients awake with this base of skull surgery?
No. So it is that awake surgery is commonly done with actual like primary brain tumors that arise from the brain tissue itself that are close to critical areas of function like speech mm-hmm. or
movement.
Mm-hmm. But in the skull base, this is never required.
I see.
And we want the patient to be stable, not moving at all, because we are dealing with like very very small areas.
Yes.
So actually, it will be almost like not wanted that the patient would be awake and have a potential of like moving.
Well, how would you know if you by accident are nicking one of these nerves or other structures that you were telling us about, the optic nerves for vision or these nerves that control the tongue or anything like that? I mean, can you see them very clearly?
So we're using like various methods and technologies to kind of navigate through the skull base. One of them is the GPS system that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Direct visualization is ideal, of course, but it can't always happen because we're dealing with very small openings.
And there's a tumor there in the
way,
right?
Yes, and there's a tumor there. So we are using the navigation system that bases itself on the MRI. That's like one thing. We use small Dopplers that kind of tell us where the main vessels will be in real time.
That's like an ultrasound machine?
That's like an ultrasound machine that can track movement of blood.
I see. So you're looking for the blood vessels that way.
Correct. So So we stay clear from them. That's like one method. Knowledge of basic anatomy, how things look at the skull base is also extremely valuable to the skull base surgeon because, for example, the optic chiasm has an impression on the skull base.
You mean where the optic nerves separate?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. And how the optic nerves move in the skull base, they leave an impression. And the surgeon can like see and track that
wow.
impression and know that the nerves would be there if the surgeon went deeper in that area.
Well, this seems to me like it would be the sort of like pick the hardest job you can pick as a neurosurgeon, right? I mean, what was it that made you think, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to be there with the microscope and the endoscope and these teeny weeny scissors. I mean, how did you decide to do this?
It was kind of like, you know, probably like one thing after the other, like brought me into being a skull-based surgeon. Like once I started my neurosurgical training, I always was interested in brain tumors. As I progressed through my training,
which is long training, right?
Yes, which is long, 7 years of neurosurgical training.
Right.
Then I did 2 years of like brain tumor fellowship, and I did another like endoscopic skull base fellowship after that.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot of years.
Yeah, it was, but it's worth it, and that's the reason people end up doing it because like although it's a very challenging field in surgery, and it's very challenging for the patients, the rewards are also very high. Like if one can help a patient from getting rid of a tumor in the skull base, it's a very rewarding feeling.
Oh, I can only imagine. And can I ask how many surgeons or surgeons and surgical assistants are involved in one of these? Is it just you, or it just sounds like you've got your endoscope, you got your other thing, you got your ultrasound. Do you do it all yourself, or do you have an assistant? Or
so I'm working in an academic center, and we have neurosurgical residents that help us do these operations. And as I mentioned, there's a surgical team, like, which is made up of an ENT surgeon and a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. And we have our own residents, so there are like four people who make the surgical team. Then there is the anesthesiology part of it. That's like another team in the OR.
And they're right nearby, right? They probably.
Yes, yes.
They're it's right. All in the face.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so
cozy.
Actually, we turn the patients, so they're actually at the feet of the table with their monitors.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of how we work it out. And and of course there is the there is the surgical techs, the nurses,
of course,
and
yes,
all the other supporting staff in the OR, which are very critical. And we have the pathologist who's there, like looking at the slides.
Right there.
I mean, in the same area.
Huh.
Where the frozen room is, and so there is that too. They're kind of indirect at that point, but they're still a part of the team. So it requires a lot of teamwork, not only in the OR, but before and after surgery as well.
Of course, yeah.
So because we are dealing with all these cranial nerves, and it's a packed area full of different tissues, we have all these like different specialties, I should say, get involved, which are like endocrinologists, ophthalmologists, neuro-ophthalmologists, neurosurgeon, ENT, kind of in the middle of it, essentially. But also, after treatment, depending on what the pathology is, the patient may require radiation treatment,
right,
which will include radiation oncologists, or oncological treatment, which will require oncologists.
Right.
So it's a very big team, and it can, depending on the patient's specifics, it can get bigger or smaller.
I can imagine. How long do these kinds of surgery take? I realize there must be a broad variety based on this location and how big the tumor is. What would be the range of such surgery in terms of duration?
So on average, the whole production, it takes about like 6 hours, mm-hmm, or so, but it can take it can be much longer.
Mm-hmm, I can imagine.
It's usually not shorter, but it can be much longer than that.
And I assume that after you've closed the thing up, and the patient probably goes to a neurosurgical intensive care unit, I'm imagining.
Yes.
Right. And do you keep them sedated for a while? Like, how long is it before you know that they're going to be okay from a neurologic function point of view, mm-hmm, talking and all that stuff?
So ideally, this is like most of the time, we actually wake patients up after surgery in the OR.
Oh, no
and
kidding.
And take the breathing tube out and examine them.
Wow.
So we don't usually keep them sedated.
Wow.
So they still go to the neuro ICU afterwards for monitoring, because at least for 24 hours. But we do wake them up and examine them immediately after surgery.
And they're not in pain or anything like that?
No, they it's uncomfortable.
I can imagine.
I have to admit that, yes,
right,
for the patient. And not only because of pain, but because when we do these surgeries through the nose, their nose is blocked. And that can be a little
it's
bit
very
uncomfortable.
I've had nose surgery, and it's really unpleasant.
Yeah.
That part's unpleasant. Like, what's in my nose?
So, but like every day they feel better, you know, but we ask them to get out of bed, start walking next day. So they do, usually when I speak to patients before surgery, they expect to be kind of knocked out in the ICU for a couple of days, but it's usually not like that. And surprisingly, people tolerate it well afterwards.
Amazing. And they don't really have, you haven't shaved their head and they don't have any marks.
There are no incisions done, everything is done inside the nose.
Dr. Bulent Omay is an assistant professor of neurosurgery at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on Connecticut Public Radio.